WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Shopping for clothes is fun for some people, but it can also be an exercise in frustration. What's fashionable today might strike you as ridiculous or look ridiculous on you. It may be difficult to find any clothes that fit and are flattering. And the prices. Andrea Siegel is a writer and fabric artist who has studied the history of fashion. And she's written a new book called Open and Clothed that considers our complicated relationships with clothes and shopping. Part of the reason she knows so much about shopping and dressing is that her great-grandfather founded the former New York department store, S. Klein's. It used to be the largest women's discount clothing store in the world, covering an entire city block at Union Square. She told me what it was like to shop there.
100,000 women a day went into and out of that store. It was completely lacking in anything we could consider atmosphere. We had, I mean, the linoleum tile was peeling off the floors. The racks of clothes were stretched out as far as the eye can see. He was entirely, Sam Klein was entirely uninterested in ambiance. He wasn't interested in getting people the best value for their dollar, which is why his store, unlike so many others, thrived after the Depression and in the years following up until the 1970s. It was a nightmare. When I was raised on stories of women falling on a garment, like two women would fall on a garment screaming, and they would pull on it until they would literally tear it apart because they were so excited about having found this designer original. Of course, you know, it's the Solomon-esque problem. You cut up the baby, you don't have a baby, you don't have the dress. People were passionate about shopping at Klein's. It was a place where you could go and there'd be a $6 cashmere sweater or there would be a Malcolm Starr dress. Malcolm Starr was one of the great designers earlier in this century for just a few bucks. It was an amazing shopping experience.
Now, you write in your new book that you were expected to shop discount even though your family had money. Now, I know Klein's had been a discount store. Was that why you were supposed to shop discount, because it was in the family's blood?
Well, I have my grandmother, who's S. Klein's daughter, will cross state lines to save a dime on a jar of peanut butter or a head of lettuce. Our family values are involved thrift and being very, very careful to get a very, very good value. It must come from there. When I was a teenager, no, I was younger than that. When my father was still alive, we used to drive to Maine from New York City, a 9-hour drive on the school holidays in order to get to the factory outlet so my father could buy his favorite shirts, and then we would drive back. My family is nuts on this subject.
What values were you taught about how to shop for clothes?
Quality matters. I now shop for my mother and my grandmother, and at thrift shops, of course. I don't shop regular retail. Just walking into a retail store fills me with anxiety. I can't understand why there are so many garments on one rack that are exactly the same. It's mystifying to me. When I buy, I just found a red cashmere jacket, pretty much new, for my grandmother at a thrift store near my house. And it's from Saks Fifth Avenue. It's beautiful. And it was $12.99. And so I give this to grandma, and she's thrilled. And part of the thrill is it's an exquisitely beautiful garment that looks wonderful on her. And the other part of the thrill is I left the price tag in the pocket. So my sense is that you've got to get the beautiful thing, the thing that makes someone really look like a flower amidst greenery. It makes them bloom. But at the same time, heaven forfend, you should spend more than $16.99 on a dress.
See, but that's the thing. You could spend your whole life shopping for clothes if you uphold both of those values. It's hard to find those beautiful things that fit that are cheap, too.
I completely disagree with you. It's one of the things that I take advantage of that at the same time fills me with despair. The tremendous excesses of our consumer culture means that thrift shopping is better than it has ever been. At least it's better than it's been since I started in the 1970s. people are buying in quantity things they will never wear, and they look at them and throw them out. The stuff in the thrift shops is amazing at this point. What was it? In the Times the other day, they said something like that the Salvation Army gets $2 to $3 billion worth of clothes a year or something. Thrift shopping is, it can be a very efficient way to find really wonderful stuff.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Siegel, and she's the author of the new book, Open and Clothed, a book where she describes as for the passionate clothes lover. Now, your great-grandfather founded S. Klein's department store in Manhattan. How did your family expect you to dress when you were growing up? And did your values clash with theirs?
I have perhaps one of the most tolerant mothers on the face of this earth, and she's very, very kind. My father was a beautifully appointed man. They don't use that phrase anymore. He was a beautifully dressed man, and he had a rigorously strict dress code, which involved always wearing the perfectly tailored wool suit, even in the middle of summer. My mother is an exquisitely dressed woman who is like me. She finds the bargain. And so between the two of them, you would expect that there would have been, or I would expect, looking back, that there would have been an expectation that I would in turn reflect them in some way. In fact, any time I experimented, you know, I got wild T-shirts, I did strange things to my hair, I got the most bizarre colored shoes available in the store, they just thought I was doing my thing and it was totally fine. After my father died, he died when I was 12, one of the ways I mourned, not surprisingly considering my obsessions, one of the things I did was I started wearing his clothes to school. Now, my father was 6 inches taller than I, and I was a plump little 12-year-old. So you can bet that in 1975, 1976, 1977, when I went to school in these clothes, I looked really strange. And my mother, I've talked to her about this subsequently, she just said to herself, you know, Andy needs to do her thing, and I'm just going to let her do it. God bless her. I mean, in school, the reaction was somewhat different. The deans kept threatening to send me home if I didn't change my clothes. And, you know, I was darned if I was, this was my way of staying connected to my dad. I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but there was no way they were going to separate me from his cornflower blue shirt, which had looked beautiful on him and looked really dumb on me. But I wore that shirt until it was in shreds. And when it was really obviously dead, there was no way I could wear it again. I wept over it because, you know, that was something that had been my dad's.
Andrea, in your book, you have a lot of very provocative questions. These are questions that you've asked people you've interviewed, and I think that you expect the reader to ask herself as well. The first question in your book is, regarding clothes, I worry, A, it's vain to think about clothes. B, thinking about clothes is one of my secret pleasures. C, I'll never look good in anything. So how would you answer that question?
Regarding my clothes?
Yeah.
I think I've gotten past the battle about it being vain to think about clothes. The thing that got me over the hump about that was a conversation I had with a professor of Italian around 1982. I was in college in Boston, and I spent a lot of time in his office because I was possibly the worst Italian student he ever had, and maybe even the worst Italian student in the history of Boston University. And I was going over and over again how to decline verbs and how to say things and how to get my, you know, my mouth wrapped around those words. And one of the things that kept distracting me was he was such a beautifully dressed man, and it wasn't flashy. It wasn't loud. It was very, very subtle. If he had a green sweater on, it would be a strange shade of green, like a forest at night, a very dark, deep green. Or his brown trousers would be subtly flecked with all sorts of different colors. And I was mesmerized by this. And I knew you're not supposed to ask your teacher about what he's wearing, but after a while, we got comfortable with each other, and I finally said, you know, you look gorgeous, and what is it with you? What are you doing? What are you thinking? And he said to me, he started telling me about his experiences as a child in Italy during World War II and some of the horrors that he witnessed as a child. And he said, I made a decision that the world is a very difficult and sometimes horrible place, and that I would do anything in my power to make it easier for other people. And one of the ways I do that is I make sure to dress beautifully so that someone seeing me walking down the street will have an experience of harmony, an experience of well-being. And he said to me, it's not that I consider myself the most beautiful person on earth, but rather that as a form of, almost a form of public service, I consider it my duty to create some more beauty in this world. And for me, that was very profound. I got to see that a love of clothing doesn't have to necessarily be allied solely with vanity and shallowness and all these things that are not really, really good for people in the long run, but it can also be a way of making a contribution.
So clothing for you is a way of expressing beauty, but as you also say in your book, clothes get to a lot of larger issues, like how you feel about your body, your self-image, your life. And I'm wondering if that ever interferes with just your pleasure in the shape and color and design of a garment. You try it on, you look at yourself, and then you start thinking about yourself and your body and how you look and so on.
Well, there's a difference. When you're trying on clothes, there are two ways you can go about it. You can try on a garment that was designed for a 6-foot-tall stick of a person who hasn't hit puberty, and it doesn't look good on you, and you can say, oh, my God, I have to suddenly change myself into a 6-foot-tall stick. I need to go on a diet. There's something wrong with me. Or you can put on a garment that's wonderful and doesn't fit and say, oh, well, this was clearly designed for someone else. You know, I really enjoy my body, even though I don't have the fashion model figure. I mean, so few people do. I'm a short, zaftig Jewish person. I've got a lot of curves where the models don't. So if I put on a garment and it doesn't suit me, it's like, well, I think I look good. I like the way I move through space. I enjoy my life. And feh, they didn't do that garment for me. You know, it's their loss. I'm not going to be wearing it and inhabiting it and making it mine.
My guest is Andrea Siegel. Her new book is called Open and Clothed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrea Siegel, a book about clothing and shopping. It's called Open and Clothed. You've interviewed a lot of people for your new book. What are some of the things you think women go through staring at themselves in dressing room mirrors?
Well, it depends on the woman. And you know, there's the whole litany in this culture, this painful repetition of, I'm so fat, I'm so ugly, oh my God, my hair, why didn't I wear good underwear? I mean, that's always the thing, you know. What is this with my underwear? I can't even bear to look at myself. People look in the mirror and one of the interesting things people do when they look in the mirror is they suck in their stomachs and they stand up really straight. And they distort their body so much that by the time they get the garment home and put it on, they wonder if someone's, you know, switched the garment. One of the things I talk to people a lot about is to slouch when you're in the dressing room, to let your stomach out, to just relax, to sit down, to stand up, to take the garment and instead of treating it like a holy object, take a fistful of that fabric and squeeze it in your hands for 10 or 15 seconds. And then when you let go, look and see if it holds the wrinkle. If it holds the wrinkle, you don't really want that thing on your body, because if you sit down in that garment once you own it and then you stand up, you're going to be a mass of wrinkles. And that's an okay look if it's for you, but for the most part, it's kind of yucky.
What are some of the ways you think feminism has affected fashion?
In a wonderful way, feminism affected fashion when the movement first started, because there had been until that point a totalitarian dictatorship. Basically, a designer in Paris or in New York said, this is what women are wearing, and women went out in droves and wore these very confining, very uncomfortable clothes. And then people started wearing, with the feminist movement, people started wearing clothes that were comfortable. That was flannel shirts and blue jeans and all these things you can move around and you don't have to worry about everyone looking at your body and judging your figure. But after several years of that, that became a uniform too. And that also was restrictive in the sense that women who loved the art of adornment, who loved a beautiful dress, felt very guilty about indulging themselves in that way and expressing themselves when it was natural to them to do so. This is changing a great deal. Feminism is a wonderful thing in the sense that it keeps embracing more and more of a humanitarian vision. But for a long time, if I had worn a Chanel suit and gone to my consciousness-raising group, they would have thought there was something wrong with me that needed to be fixed. And nowadays, it's really, really shifting. You can have your love and pleasure in painting your nails, in wearing a pair of satin mules, and you can have your values, which say, you know, very simply, that we all deserve equal rights.
Andrew, this... I want to share with you one of my clothes and shopping frustrations.
Oh, please,
okay,
please.
Yeah, and tell me if you've run across, in the course of your professional work and your interviews for your new book, other women who feel this way. I like clothes, and I like to feel that I'm looking my best, but clothes are a source of constant frustration to me. I think it's in part because I'm very short and kind of narrow-boned. The only sizes that fit me are petite sizes. You go to a wonderfully hip boutique, and they don't have anything at all that comes close to fitting. So you're making constant compromises and never really feeling like you're quite getting what it is that you'd really like to wear. But who wants to spend their whole life shopping for clothes when that's not, you know, if you're in the position where that's not what you do? You know, here's an example. You know, I shop in kids' departments sometimes, like Gap for Kids and department store kids' departments. So I got a sweater recently in a department store, and here's what the label says. The brand is Your Generation. And the label
yes.
says, Team Captain, Big Sister, Mother's Favorite, Wow, Are You Busy. Luckily, we keep the pace with everything that's happening now. This is my children's department sweater.
Oh, I love this.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, did you find a lot of other women who, for one reason or another, are not shaped in such a way that they could buy what they really want to buy? And it's just a constant set of frustration and compromise.
Now, basically, most people have bought into this myth that ready-to-wear clothes are ready-to-wear, and they're really not. Ready-to-wear clothes are ready-to-wear if you're about 6 feet tall, you have a streak of grandiosity about the size of Grand Canyon, and you like to wear really, really high heels. I mean, that's most ready to wear just isn't. You really need to find a really good tailor. No one talks about this, and people who dress impeccably know this. You have to find someone who's willing to make those quote-unquote ready-to-wear garments bear some resemblance that's flattering to your figure. Now, finding a tailor is a quest that's entirely worth taking, and it's a hit or miss thing. The first time you visit a tailor, don't take a garment you really, really love, because heaven forfend, they should cut into it, and then you'll be left with the rags of something that once could have been great. But it's worth, this is just personal advice, it's worth hunting down a good tailor to get those garments to really work for you.
You make a lot of garments. You shop at a lot of thrift stores. How connected do you feel to the fashion world, you know, the official fashion world?
It gives me the creeps, the official fashion world. One of the very funny things to me that happened as a result of writing this book was it was sent out to a great many fashion magazines. And I got a call from Vogue magazine, for example, after they got the book. And this very nice young woman said, "Oh, I really love the book. It's so interesting, but it's too belt and suspenders for Vogue." I'm like, what is she talking about? I'm trying to think about this. And then finally I just said, "I really don't understand what you mean by belt and suspenders." Clearly they talk another language there. No, there was a long silence, and clearly she was taken aback. She wasn't used to being questioned about her use of English. And she said, "Oh, it's too servicey. And I thought, I have no idea what she is talking about. Fortunately, another a wonderful editor over at Allure Magazine, Jessica Green, called me a little while later, and we were talking about the book, and she said, "Oh yeah, it's a little servicey, but you know that's I love it. I think it's great." And I said, "Well, can you tell me what it means? What is this servicey?" She said, "Oh, it's useful. It's helpful. It's informative." And basically, the fashion magazines, the fashion industry, is about fantasy. It's about entertainment. I'm really interested in meeting people where they live, where they're with their clothes. You know, what is your personal life like? What are the flavors and colors and details that make it interesting and vital to you? What's unique about your life? The fashion industry is just projecting a fantasy. For the people who I interviewed, I was very surprised to find that they weren't interested in fashion either. It's kind of irrelevant. It's really fun that it's out there. It's fun when I have the sniffles and I get three or four fashion magazines and I get a bowl of chicken soup and I thumb through the fashion magazines and drink my soup and I feel much better. But in terms of its actual relevance to my life, it's very, very difficult to find a correspondence there.
Andrea Siegel is the author of the new book, Open and Clothed, for the Passionate Clothes Lover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.